So this afternoon I'd like to reflect a little further on the theme of equanimity. I just ask you, can you hear me if I talk at this volume? It's okay? I don't have to shout. Great. And I'd like to begin by reading to you something a mother wrote as she nursed her 3-year-old daughter who was dying of cancer. And she said it was right then that it happened. It was such a strange and glorious thing that if I hadn't experienced it myself, I wouldn't have believed it was possible. I forgot that Hannah was sick. I wasn't even aware of having forgotten. It was if I had been sucked out of the story of cancer, treatment, worry, and death. Hannah was playing in the dirt, and I was visiting with a friend. It was a moment of nothing special, of nothing going on. In a flash, whatever had sucked me up spit me out again. Even so, something felt different. Although I remembered now that Hannah was sick, some part of the stillness had remained. Later, I sat on the front porch, peeling away the layers of the night sky. The night sky was like my life, each layer a level of experience. No element or moment of it was more or less, better or worse than any other. Each was an offering to the whole in its suspended, inky stillness. Listening to the night, I felt poised on the edge of greatness, certain that the silence I was feeling was sacred. I think we probably all have moments in our own life amongst the swirling events and all the joys and sorrows coming to us that we can also find ourselves touched by intimations of great inner stillness, a stillness that embraces the whole of our life. And many times those glimpses can feel rather startling. They can take us by surprise. We can move in a moment from intense preoccupation and worry and obsession and planning to a place of great calm, of great stillness and poise. And those moments for us are actually a glimpse of equanimity. An equanimity whose nature is unshakable balance and stillness. Now, equanimity is sometimes described as a spacious stillness of mind, or as a radiant calm or inner poise. In other traditions, it's called a shamanic equilibrium. Yet this unshakable balance is not something that is removed or distant from life, but is within it, and within our willingness and capacity to meet all the moments in our life with equal respect, compassion, and sensitivity. Equanimity may not be always something that we gain. It may be born really of what we let go of. Our willingness to surrender our views that so set us into positions of being for and against. Our willingness to let go of some of the agitation of avoidance and pursuit, of seeking and denial. As I mentioned this morning, in the Tibetan tradition, equanimity is described as being equally near all things. And I think it is so intriguing the way in this practice and tradition, equanimity and compassion are seen to be such close companions, so interwoven together. Because we see every time we turn on the television or read the newspaper or are touched by any of the tragedies in our world, we see that somehow for us to really be still, to be able to really embrace that degree of suffering we see outwardly and inwardly, somehow we need to find the way to put down our ideas of right and wrong, of should and should not, and sense what it means just to simply meet sorrow and pain without fear. I'm sure we've all sensed that for us to really deeply listen to the story of another person or to the story of life itself, somehow we need to find the willingness to let go of our own story about it. Our story that too often holds all the history and fear and prejudice we can bring to the moment. So we learn to calm inwardly, to become more still. My understanding of equanimity is that it is the forerunner of wise speech. It's the forerunner of wise action, a forerunner of wise choice and compassion. I'm sure we've all sensed that the responses that we've ever engaged in our life that can truly make any difference at all, that those responses are very rarely born of agitation or fear or craving, but of stillness and openness and balance. Hui Neng, in speaking of equanimity, he said, to what should we compare equanimity and wisdom? They are like the light of a lamp. Having the lamp, you can have light, but with no lamp, there is darkness. Because the lamp is the basis of the light, and the light is the use of the lamp. Though they are two names, the basis is the same. The teaching of equanimity and wisdom is just like this. Equanimity is not a place, it's not a state, it's not something we attain and then it stays fixed and we retire somehow. Equanimity is an ongoing journey. And just as life doesn't and will never stand still for us, somehow frozen in time where nothing ever changes anymore, equanimity has to be as fluid as our life is. Equanimity must be a way of meeting that shifting life, the changes in our bodies and minds and all of the events that come to us. Now, I think we often may feel that this kind of inner stillness is somehow just unreachable for us or impossible for us. We may feel that it's really just too hard to be balanced and steady amidst all the changes and extremes in our life. But I think it only takes a brief moment of reflection to know how much harder it is to be perpetually lost in the extremes of love and hate and happiness and despair, of for and against. Now, it's probably obvious that equanimity is not a word we use very much in our culture. I mean, we very rarely say, I feel deeply equanimous today. Or I've had a really equanimous day. But think of all the other words that we use so much more often. We say, I love this, or I really hate this, or I look forward to tomorrow, or I really dread the next sitting, I'm really against that. You know, we say, I really need this, I really want this. You know, if you run into somebody you haven't seen in a while and they ask you how you've been, it's like that question opens this door in which we pour out all of the stories of the events that have happened to us or happened within us. We say, I've just had such a dreadful time, or life is really exciting right now, or, I've been really sad, or I've been really fearful, or I've been in love. Rarely would we ever feel happy to say, nothing has happened. Nothing's happened. My mind has been unmoving. toys has been my home. It's almost, I think, in our culture, to say something like that would be like to present ourselves as being in this incredibly dull, uninteresting, unexciting person that mostly people would ignore. It's like we have to have intensity to be somebody. It's almost like intensity or events is what makes us someone worthy in this world. Then it's no surprise, is it, that we spend so much of our time chasing events, even with a kind of strange addiction to intensity almost. It's interesting that when the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment, that's exactly what he said, nothing happened. He's saying, I gained absolutely nothing from complete, unexcelled enlightenment. And then we would think, well, why would he, you know, what, why then, you know, why bother with all of this? I think one way of framing our life is to see it as this unceasing, almost unstoppable flow of events, one following on the heels of another. It's like that song, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. You know, it's like we can't get out of that flow of events. One way of seeing our life is like this, is like a great river that starts as just a tiny, tiny spring that comes to the surface and that grows and grows in power. And in the course of that river, there's stretches of white water and there's stretches of calm water, there's rapids and play long, long stretches of calm that then turn into whirlpools and then even out again. And we would see that in the course of that river, you know, that we can't, I mean, apart from extreme means, stop the river. And in the same way, we can't stop the arising and passing of events in our life. We can't choose to have only the stretches of calm. Life will surprise us. Something will crumble. Something unexpected will arise. Something will fall apart. We're not even sure that we want only the stretches of calm. But nor could we choose only ever to stay in the white water and the rapids. It would simply be too unbearable for us. Now, in the events of our life, we can be sure that we will all have our own measure of praise and of blame, of approval and disapproval, of gain and loss, of pleasure and pain. In this tradition, these are called the eight worldly dharmas. And in a way, it's a way of describing the events or the polarities in our life that most lead us to be knocked off balance. It's a way of describing the extremes in our life that most lead us to the inner extremes of happiness and sorrow, of despair and hope, of craving and aversion. If we think of all of the events within our single life, what the Buddha called the 10,000 joys and sorrows. And so many of these events seem almost designed, almost created, to kind of pull the rug out from under us, to knock us off balance. And I don't think any of us can ever imagine reaching a point in our life where we have enough armor or enough defense to keep the world of events at bay. I don't think any of us could ever imagine reaching a point in our life where we could say with some certainty, now I have everything under control. Nothing is ever going to ambush me again. I'm never going to be startled again by change. That we could reach a point where we say, oh, you know, at last, finally, ultimate sort of order has been achieved. I think the only thing that we can count on in this life is that nothing is going to stay the same. That nothing is ever going to truly belong to us. That nothing will remain. You know, we see this so often. I know my colleagues and I, when we teach, you know, we see this so often, this kind of world of praise and blame, of approval and disapproval, of gain and loss. You know, we could give a talk sometimes on a retreat, you know, and you get, you know, I don't know why this happens on retreat, why people feel the need to write you notes after you give a talk. But, you know, you get 10 notes and say, oh, fantastic talk, you know, great. And you get another 10 notes and say, but you really missed the point. And do you ever think you could improve on, you know, how you do this? But don't we see this in our own lives, you know? We gain some approval. Someone tells us how wonderful we are, you know, or how well we have done something. And we sort of bask in it, you know. We tell ourselves, you know, really, I'm a pretty great person, you know. I'm really getting somewhere. And then something else we do, you know, attracts a different kind of feedback, a disapproval or a level of censure. And we find ourselves sinking inwardly. We feel ashamed. We feel inadequate. We feel unworthy. These eight worldly dharmas, we're always swinging in them. You know, our fantastic meditation, the one we always wanted to have. You know, our great love, the state of our health, our youth, our importance. All of it will be lost. Not only can be lost, all of it will be lost, for sure. It can change into something less welcome. Our pleasure turns into pain. After the tsunami in Asia, a woman who lives in a village near where I live, she said she received a postcard from her son who died in the tsunami. He said, I'm in heaven. I'm having the best time of my life. And these changes between pleasure and pain are not always so life-shattering. But we see it happening on subtler levels. You know, the sound of the bird that we were so enjoying gets replaced by the chainsaw. You know, the delightful fantasy we were so having such a good time in, suddenly we realize it's turned into an obsession. Fall in love with someone can feel so delightful. Then we realize actually we've never met that person. They're just another yogi on the retreat. And actually the pleasant also has its deeply, deeply painful side. But pain can also turn to delight. You know, we can be lost in some terribly, terribly gripping obsession, emotional storm, and walk outside and suddenly just the sight of a tree or the sun on the grass so touches us, and we can feel ourselves shift out of that storm into something we would never have imagined be possible. The pain that we're sure is going to be there forever suddenly starts to heal. It does seem that our sense of inner balance can feel so fragile and so precarious. And yet the truth is, in the midst of all of these events, we still breathe, our hearts beat, we go from morning to night, we remain present and alive. And sometimes I think we ask ourselves even, how can our hearts absorb, continue to absorb these extremes and these events in our life without being shattered? And sometimes we ask ourselves, how can we find the equanimity to meet these events and extremes with equal respect, without being governed? And how deeply can we understand that our efforts to control the uncontrollable are truly in vain, and that in reality they only make us suffer? I think equanimity really does ask for the wisdom of a Buddha. It's not only the outer events in our life that ask us to find this radical calm, but also the inner events. I wonder how many of you watched the World Cup. Rather than pulling my hair out in the privacy of my own home, I joined the managers at Gaia House to watch this event in the pub. Well, you have never seen such a loss of equanimity. I mean, it was extraordinary. And what was also curious is that we went to the pub nearest to Gaia House, and there were all of these yogis who'd snuck out of the... out of the retreat and suddenly turned around to find one of the teachers sitting behind them. Which I'm sure did something to their equanimity as well. I remember the last American presidential election, I was in the States and I was sitting with a bunch of friends waiting for the returns to come in. And it, you know, seeing that roller coaster, you know, where this sense of hope turned to depression, you know, and the depression got lifted by a little bit of optimism that got dashed again, you know, and then we were all waiting for Ohio. Ohio disappointed us. But what was curious in all of those waves, you know, of high and low, of sadness and elation and despair and hope, was the awareness that there were countless other people around the world and around the country watching exactly the same events, experiencing exactly the same feelings, but at totally opposite times. You know, so that my hope was somebody else's despair, you know, and their despair was my optimism. And what was so extraordinary was the reflection of this kind of subjectivity of our perceptions and how they form our world and how our preferences, so often our views, our opinions, our preferences are almost like volunteering for suffering. It's like, oh, I'll just volunteer, you know. I'll just hold on to that one, and I'll just volunteer for suffering, knowing that that clinging is just going to completely knock me off balance. Then there's the question, does equanimity mean that we're rather cold? Does equanimity mean that nothing touches us? Does equanimity mean that we never feel anything deeply or passionately, that we're never sad or never happy, or that we never experience sorrow or joy? I don't think so. There's something I'll read you which some of you know, but I'm going to read it anyway because it's so great. It says, if you can sit quietly after difficult news, if in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you can see your neighbors travel to fantastic places without a twinge of jealousy, if you can happily eat whatever is put on your plate, if you can love those around you unconditionally, if you can fall asleep after a day of running around without a drink or a pill, if you can always find contentment just where you are, you're probably a dog. Did I say you're probably a Buddha? But no, you're probably a dog. Equanimity does not mean the absence of feeling, but it does mean the presence of balance within the world of feeling. Very, very different things. So if equanimity is not a state, equanimity, I think, is an embodiment and a manifestation of insight. It's an embodiment and manifestation of wisdom. And then I think it is really useful to explore what is the wisdom element of equanimity. Well, the first cornerstone is to find the willingness and the capacity to embrace the reality of impermanence. A capacity that often follows on the heels of willingness. Can we truly understand that written upon every single thing that comes into being that is born is the story of its passing and death. Our moments of fame and disgrace, our loves and our hates, our pleasures, our pains, our gains, our losses, none of them are graspable. They are all equally held in the fabric of change and impermanence. We know this. We know this. Intellectually, we all know this. And at the same time, it's a place where we are subject to the greatest bouts of amnesia. We often use the word forever. It's a thought we often have. Either we want something to be forever, or we're afraid it will be forever. We so lose sight of the power of deeply understanding impermanence, which is truly to allow the tide of events in our lives to take their own course as they will, without taking hold of any of them. Without deeply embracing impermanence, we get lost in aversion and resistance. We become equally lost in forgetfulness. We expend heroic efforts, really heroic efforts, to try and keep and maintain and make things remain, things that are already passing. We fall into the extremes of being for and against, of running from away from things that are already passing. It's so interesting to me with impermanence. It's something that we talk about all the time, and we all nod our heads very knowingly, you know. Yeah, I know about impermanence. And yet we can totally live like not in the light of impermanence, as if it applies to everything but not us. You know, it has to do with everybody except me. It struck me, you know, recently when I was traveling after the latest security scare, you know, it was so interesting to me, like when I went to the airport, you know, first of all, your airline sent you an email saying you couldn't take any liquids on board, you know. Then you get to the airport terminal, there's signs plastered everywhere, you know, no liquids on board, you know. You get in the security lineup, you got all these people shouting at you, you know, no liquids on board. And then you get to the security point, and what do you have? About 90% of people have got liquids in their bags. It's like, this has nothing to do with me. You know, and isn't that how we think often about death, about how we think about change, about how we think about impermanence? It's got nothing to do with me. You know, as if we live in some sort of bubble, exempted bubble. Exempt from everything else. You know, years ago when I went to IMS and I was teaching, you know, it was a bit like Gaia House. You know, it used to have this massive assortment of chipped cutlery and plates and cups, you know, and all these weird things. And people would spend a lot of time looking for their favorite plate, etc. But they decided they were going to change all of this kind of, you know, unique motley collection to this kind of standardized white dishes. Be aware, this is also going to happen at Gaia House. And really, you would have thought this was a very, you know, in the service of good health, you know, and cleanliness and all of this stuff. It was like we had, you know, burnt the building down. You know, all these notes, you know, what have you done with my favorite cup? You know, I even got a note saying this has really upset my retreat. And this is in a center where we do talk really quite often about impermanence. I think we don't always realize how much we rely on the great and the small things in our life staying the same for us to feel balanced and calm. I don't think we often realize that until something changes. And then we realize the depth to which our happiness has depended on things being predictable, staying the same. And I think when we see the ways, the times we get knocked off balance, we see often how strong this thread of grasping is that runs through our life. And bearing in mind that grasping in itself is the amnesia that surrounds impermanence. I mean, if we truly understand change, then there's really not much point in grasping hold of anything, is there? Not a thought, not a sensation, not a state, not an experience. And if we truly appreciate impermanence, it really kind of makes a mockery of clinging. Clinging just doesn't make any sense at all. Now, it strikes me that none of us are short of opportunities to contemplate impermanence. You know, beginnings and endings, births and deaths, arisings and passings. If we just open our hearts to the simple truth of a single moment, a single hour, a single day, and ask, what is it teaching us? Ask, what really have we learned today? And the one lesson that is stamped on everything is that this too will pass. This too will pass. And understanding this is really one of the primary cornerstones of equanimity. Primary cornerstone. I think another of the wisdom elements, or another of the cornerstones of equanimity, is to really be interested in and to investigate and to understand the nature of our own intoxication with events. I mean, if someone offered you a lifelong free pass to the highest roller coaster in the world, you know, initially, depending on your temperament, you might feel that this was quite a prize. And the first few rides, you would probably even enjoy the thrill and the exhilaration. Not only the intensity of the ride, but, you know, the intensity of that emotion. And then imagine if you had to do that ride day after day, hour after hour. I think after a while, the thrill would wear pretty thin. But strangely, we don't seem to lose the intoxication with riding the roller coaster of events in our life, inwardly and outwardly, in the same way. And we can see when there's that kind of intoxication that equanimity really disappears. So what draws us? What enchants us? What is intensity all about for us? What is the intensity of highs and lows, of gains and loss? What does that intensity really mean for us? Why do we sometimes find ourselves prowling the world looking for the new experience? Huh? What does the extremes of love and hate and gain and loss, what do they feed, actually, in us? I think it takes really only a little bit of awareness to see that our sense of who we are, our sense of me, who I am, is also an event that arises and passes in countless forms in relationship to other events through our day, through our life. I mean, if you just reflect back on the last hour, how many self events did you experience? How many events of selfing did you experience? I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm disappointed that the quiche ran out, I'm happy I got there before the chocolate did. You know, I'm happy my meditation's getting somewhere, pretty disappointed my meditation's not getting anywhere. I'm young, I'm old, I'm anxious, I'm excited. The events of selfing arising and passing always co-joined with other events that are arising and passing. The inner events of our emotions, thoughts, opinions, reactions, and the outer world of events are mutually codependent. They are co-joined, they are interrelated. Sometimes our sense of self in the moment is flavored by an outer event. You know, you're sitting very quietly on the precipice of enlightenment and the lawnmower starts up. then you see, you know, the angry or the anxious self jump into the forefront. You know, why did that happen to me? Why did it happen right now? It didn't happen to me. It's just a lawnmower. But why did it happen to me? Sometimes outer events are flavored by the inner event of selfing. You know, there might be a memory, an emotion that is sad or angry arising, and then we see how the outer world seems just a world of irritation. Just a world that is there to kind of upset us. And the real question is, of course, you know, who would we be outside of these events? Who would we be without the definition of an event? And I think that this is the source of our intoxication. I really need an event to be someone. And the thought of being no one is so unfamiliar and so initially unsettling that we resist it fiercely. And so there are no end of the events that life offers us, the possibility of being someone. The short answer to who would we be without the definition of an event is that we would be equanimous. We would be equanimous. The wonderful Zen haiku, it says, 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. And the unnecessary things are our positions of being for and against, liking, disliking, fear, anticipation. The unnecessary things is holding on to the changing events of selfing. And when our mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, I think our equanimity can be very rich, very deep, very responsive. I think the third dimension of insight, which is the cornerstone of equanimity, is really being mindful of what I was speaking of this morning already, being mindful of this feeling tone that permeates all things. In Pali, the word is Vedana. It's the second foundation of mindfulness, to know the pleasant as pleasant, the unpleasant as unpleasant, and the neutral as neutral. When we are unmindful of Vedana, unmindful of those feeling tones, we often take the first step towards intoxication, towards being knocked off balance. To cultivate equanimity, we are asked to cultivate it in the very places where we are not equanimous. And that is often within the spectrum of feelings that arise. There is much that is pleasant in life, not always as much as we would like, but there are many sounds, sights, thoughts, tastes, touch, which are indeed pleasant. And equanimity doesn't demand that we resist the pleasant, because it's also, the pleasant is the root of joy, it's the root of rapture, of loving kindness. But it's also, the pleasant is also the place where we can build our house of craving, of restlessness. We see this so many times, you know, you could walk outside here. And, you know, the moment the sun was shining this morning, it can be quite delightful, it's really quite lovely. And we could also take a lot more steps with that, can't we? Well, I practice much better in the sun. You know, my next retreat's going to be in Spain, you know. Or, you know, well, now the sun's gone. You know, my practice is much worse, you know. How can I possibly be mindful in the cold? And we can turn the pleasant into a project. Well, we turn it into a project, something we have to do something with, something that we kind of possess. There's probably more unpleasant Vedana in life than we would like. Unpleasant feelings. But our disliking and our resistance won't shelter us from them. A rainy day, I think this is terrible, you know. It's really awful to walk in this, to be in this. I'm living in the wrong country. You know, there is much in life that is neutral, that's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. This is where we tend just to space out. But it's so interesting, as I mentioned this morning, to learn to practice in the neutral zone, to learn to be mindful in the neutral zone. You know, because too often we just say, oh, this is boring. You know, breathing is boring. You know, sitting is boring, walking is boring. You can feel that impulse of craving starting to arise. But if we really practice in the neutral zone and we take away the aversion, we start to open that door to a great calmness, a great stillness, a great peace. And we really start actually to get a flavor in the neutral zone of the possibilities of equanimity that will be brought to the pleasant and to the unpleasant. The path of equanimity is really not separate from the world of suffering and chaos, but it is really cultivated within it. In the midst of change, in the midst of suffering, learning that we can embrace the world of events without becoming an event ourselves. Then we can find the compassion and the steadiness. There's a way in which I think of the real fruition of mindfulness as being eventless mindfulness. You know, I think often in our practice you can get a sense, maybe you can get your head around this, but often in our practice we're always so interested in the contents of our experience, aren't we? You know, oh, there's that thought, that emotion, you know, that mental state, that memory, that plan. And it's often, it's like, what makes something into an event in our mind? It's because it's isolated and it's surrounded by a certain amount of either craving or aversion. That's what makes something into an event in our mind. And what really happens as the calmness really deepens, as the mindfulness deepens, is that the tendency to isolate anything in the mind and turn it into an event calms. And we begin to get actually a taste of eventless mindfulness. It's not death. The mind is still happening. Life is still happening. But there's no isolating and no contracting around anything that arises in the mind. And so what one really gets one sense is this home in this deeply equanimous seeing. And then maybe you also get a sense of why the Buddha said, you know, nothing happened. Nothing happened. Thank you for your attention. If we take just a couple of moments quietly together. Mm-hmm.